From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. For the average NPR listener, hearing the name Garrison Keillor may summon up the sound of his voice, deep and soothing, wise and mischievous, or a favorite of his monologues about Lake Wobegon. Keillor is a prolific writer, storyteller, humorist, and radio host. With a style uniquely his own, he has done for the Midwest what the Grand Ole Opry did for the South. Keillor's new book, The Keillor Reader, was released to coincide with the 40th anniversary of his iconic radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. Prairie Home debuted on July 6, 1974, to an audience of 12. It now has 4 million weekly listeners on more than 600 public radio stations. Garrison Keillor spoke at Seattle's University Bookstore on June 12, 2014. Thanks to Ayan Sheikh and University Bookstore for this recording.
Well, here we are in the midst of literary criticism and poetry and fiction over there and English as a second language, which it may well become for some of us, writing in reference as well. It's good to be here near this great campus, even though being close to a university campus just brings back memories of dreadful failure and misery. But we need not talk about that. It was about 3 years ago, I had an appointment to go down to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota for an MRI to see if they could figure out why I had these chronic headaches. It was in February, 3 years ago, and I was in St. Paul at home. I was at home alone and stayed up late and then got up very early the next morning. I had an 8 o'clock appointment, and I got up around 5, and sheets of snow were falling. It was a genuine blizzard, except without so much wind blowing in the city. You could not see the house across the street, and I seldom listened to the radio, but I did turn on the radio that morning, and they said, no unnecessary driving. Highway Patrol says to stay off the roads, which for somebody from Minnesota is like a bugle call. And so you get into your old Volvo and never mind your boots and your scarf, just get in your car and head down the road, lest somebody stop you. And so I headed on my way down Highway 52, which is a four-lane divided highway, heading south from St. Paul to Rochester, Minnesota. Goes through Zumbrota and Cannon Falls. And visibility was really poor, but I was going about 55, almost 60, and semi pulled up in the passing lane on my left, a semi pulling a trailer of steel pipe, and he pulled up even with me. And for reasons that I can't explain, but many men here will understand, I did not want him to pass me, and I decided that he would not. And so I stepped on the gas, and we were each of us going about 65 in very little visibility. I was busy at the time. My wife was in New York, and she had called me on the cell phone, so I was listening to her. She was crossing Central Park at around 90th Street, and she was on her way to have coffee with a friend of hers who sings in the Metropolitan Opera Chorus, and she was then going to go to the Metropolitan Museum and see the Matisse exhibit. and she was so delighted. There were crocuses coming up in the park, and she could see the leaves of tulips. So I was listening to her on the cell phone, and I was also trying to get a CD out of the CD player, which had gotten stuck in there. And so my hands were occupied, and I was sort of bracing my left thigh against the steering wheel, heading south at 65 miles an hour through sheets of snow with a semi a few feet off the port side. And we came over a rise where the wind was blowing snow across a cornfield, across corn stubble. And it was a drift about 3 feet deep, I would guess, and about a quarter mile long. And we hit it, he and I, together at the same time. And snow just boiled up, this snow that you caught in your headlights and just blinding white. It was like the rapture. It just came up in your face. I didn't take my foot off the gas. I just didn't think to do that. I did hear this long diesel honk, and then we got out of the blindness, and I discovered that I was in the left-hand lane, and he was now in the right-hand lane. And he had fallen behind, but he was catching up quickly. And he was making some sort of hand gestures. See. It was a chastening moment for a Minnesota man. I reached up and I fastened my seatbelt and headed on down to Rochester, staying barely ahead of him, and made it on time for my 8 o'clock appointment. You go down to radiology and they give you a dressing room. You take off your clothes, you put on a little flowery gown, one fore and one aft, and you lie down on a gurney. They wheel you into where the great cyclotron is, and you climb onto a little platform that's on a rail, and they run you up the rail until your head and shoulders are inside the machine for half an hour of wanging and banging and dinging and honking. You lie there and you keep your eyes closed lest you have an attack of claustrophobia. It's very cramped inside the MRI machine. You have your eyes closed and you realize that this platform on which you are lying is about exactly the size of a coffin, and your hands are folded on your abdomen, and your eyes are closed, and you sort of imagine your loved ones walking by and looking down at you, and wondering why you're wearing this flowery gown. They finish, and you wait for half an hour to talk to the neurologist. And he calls you into his office. He's a man of science. He's very matter of fact. He has a picture of your brain there on his computer screen on his desk. Your brain, the center of your being as a writer, where all of your material is, everything that's ever happened to you, everything that you might ever write about in the future is all up there. You do not want to look at it, but you do. And he points to two little dark spots on it. Those are blood clots, he says. Those were fired up out of your atrium, and they lodged there, luckily, in what we neurologists refer to as a silent part of the brain, a place where not much is going on. You might think of this as the Wyoming of the brain. It's some people have more of it than others, and there they landed by pure chance. Had they landed just about a millimeter over here, you would have major speech issues now, and you probably would need to be relearning how to take basic sounds and make them into words, which you did with much less trouble when you were a year and a half, 2, 3 years old. You would be struggling with that had it landed right there. And had one landed right there, you would have some mobility issues, and you might have to be seeing a physical therapist to relearn how to walk. He said this all just very matter-of-factly, and I listened to it and went off to think about it down in the cafeteria, having a bowl of Campbell's tomato soup and an egg salad sandwich, which I've always found to be comforting, and thinking about how close one came to disaster. We all know, intellectually at least, about the precariousness of life, but here it was, right there before your eyes. This could have been very different, you think to yourself, and you look around the cafeteria at Mayo and you see all sorts of elderly people your age who for whom things have turned out differently. You sit and you ponder this, and what occurs to you is that you have been granted an enormous stroke of good luck, which carries with it a certain obligation to do something with this good fortune. How fortunate for you that you did not wind up in a ditch under 15 tons of steel pipe, so that you could come to Mayo and find out how lucky you are. This, it seems to me, is the great lesson that one learns at this advanced age, where I've arrived without really meaning to. That it's not about hard work, although we do work hard, oftentimes doing exactly the wrong thing. And it's not about talent. Nobody really knows what that is exactly. It's about blind, stupid luck. This is what I have come to believe, and this is why I'm not asked to deliver the commencement address at colleges or universities. Because this is a truth which has been withheld from young people such as yourselves. They want you to believe that you are special, which indeed you are, as everyone is, but blind, stupid luck. My advice, in a nutshell, is to be prepared to be lucky and recognize it when it's there. And when it comes to you, feel profoundly grateful and then go on and do something else. This is what I see looking back at my own life.
We'll be right back with more of this talk by Garrison Keillor. His new book, The Keillor Reader, is a collection of writings spanning his long career. After the break, Keillor shares his gratitude for being kicked out of shop class many years ago, and much more. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Garrison Keillor started his weekly radio show, A Prairie Home Companion, in 1974. We intended the show to last for a year or maybe two, he writes. But just as we were about to quit, the show started to draw an audience, 50, 100, 200 people coming to see it on a Saturday night. And we kept going so we could figure out what we were doing right. Next up, more of the accidents and intentions that led to his brilliant career.
This is the thing about being 71, is that you can see things a little more clearly looking back over your own life. And you see how small events carried great sway, how when Mr. Beeler kicked you out of shop class because you were failing ball peen hammer and you were failing plywood and sheet metal, and you were talking, he kicked you up into Miss Lavona Pearson's speech class, and this made an enormous difference to give a speech and to look out over your classmates and not look at them because they were making faces, they were crossing their eyes, they were letting their tongues droop from their mouths, they were pulling invisible things out of their nostrils. You look back at Miss Pearson, and she stood in the back of the room smiling at you, this beautiful beatific smile, and that smile follows you. You never forget this. Nothing you do for children is ever wasted. It carries and carries and carries, even though you may never see the outcome of it. You look back and you see the time that you went out for football because you grew up in a football town and this was what boys did. But the doctor heard a click in your mitral valve and wouldn't sign the permission slip, which was heartbreaking for about an hour and a half. And then you, on your own, got the bright idea to go down to the town paper and ask if they needed a sports writer, knowing that they didn't have one. This was a failing paper. It was about to go out of business about 2 years later, the Anoka Herald. And the editor, Mr. Feist, looked at you, this kid with wire-rimmed glasses and a home haircut standing there in his office door in front of the glass case full of wedding invitations. And he decided on his own that you were the son of Lawrence Keeler, who was the vice president of the First National Bank of Anoka. He didn't know that you were the son of John Keeler, who worked in the post office sorting mail. And because the First National Bank held the mortgage for the paper, you were hired on the basis of false identity. And you were happy for it and never saw reason to correct it. And so instead of sitting down at the end of the bench with the other B-squatters, you sat up in the press box, way up high over the field, and you sat very close to the men from the AM radio station who were doing play-by-play, Chuck and Rod, so that you knew what was going on. And you wrote a story for the paper, and you took it down to the paper on Monday afternoon, and you gave it to Whitey or Russ, the two linotype operators, both of them confirmed alcoholics, who sat there at the linotype machine and drank this horrible paint thinner out of Dixie cups. You gave it to them, and they set it in type, and these enormous machines that gave off clouds of heat because there was an open flame under the bucket of lead, so when he finished typing a line, he pulled a lever and the lead poured in to make the slug, and the slug went into the galley, and the galley up on the chase, and the turtle went down into the flatbed press, and you could come in on Wednesday and see Whitey stand there and take one sheet at a time off this great stack of newsprint and lay it down flat and pull the lever and whoosh, the chunk chunk chunk, the roller came over and then down it slid into the folder, which trimmed it up, and you could reach down into the chute and pull out a folded copy of the Anoka Herald and turn it to page 12. And there, under your name, was your story, and you could imagine hundreds of dozens of people, your aunts anyway, looking forward to reading this. You'll never get over this. This confirms you in a choice, the love of paper and fresh ink is irresistible. It's why I love bookstores. I can walk in and smell that smell, and it's freighted with all of these beautiful, beautiful memories. You look back on these things and you just see one stroke of luck after another. You see your own grievous mistakes, and you see your own arrogance and your own carelessness and all of your own faults, but your life is marked by these strokes of luck. I believe in this. I really truly do. Radio was a piece of great luck for me, and nothing that I ever planned or had ambitions to do, truly. I wouldn't lie to you about it. I might lie to you about other things, but, you know. My ambition was to be a writer and to be brilliant, to be a genius, actually. And that's what I was planning on. My model was Edgar Allan Poe, I think, and his love poems to dead women, which I truly love, The Lost Lenore and Annabel Lee, whose kinsman came and bore her away from me and shut her up in a sepulcher in a tomb by the sounding sea. This was my idea of great poetry. And then I read a little bit of Jack Kerouac, and then I was impressed by that and by the idea of stream of consciousness sentences that went on for pages, and all of it opaque and surrealistic and sort of tortured. That was my idea, that a brilliant poet would die young, probably. This would be your obligation, really, to your own talent, not to venture onto the shallows of middle age, you know, but to die in the bloom of youth, like Buddy Holly did, and like Janis Joplin and James Dean, so that you would be immortalized as a 20-year-old, and people would grieve for your talent and your short life, which didn't give you enough time to bring this talent under control. I wasn't sure that I had this talent, was one problem. Some people thought I did because I was a loner and I was bookish and I didn't make eye contact, which I still don't. I mean, it doesn't make sense in radio. And nowadays, they would say high-functioning end of the autism spectrum, but back then they had a more generous interpretation of eccentricity, back when there was so much less of it. And so I assumed I would die young, and I set out to write dark, surrealistic poetry. But there just wasn't occasion for it, you know. Death, that is. I was cautious by nature, and there never was a good reason to charter a small plane in a snowstorm. heroin was very hard to find in rural Minnesota at the time. Not now, but back then it was. And so I lived on to the age of 30, and that's really too old to die young. And that's when I came up with my so-called career in radio and a Prairie Home Companion. It started out early in the morning. It wasn't on Saturday at 5 o'clock Central Time, 3 o'clock Pacific. It was early in the morning and just broadcast in Minnesota. And when you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do a radio show, it dawned on you that this dark vision you had for yourself was no longer of any use at all. You had to find something else. I come from this era in which, as you may know, all major American writers were confirmed alcoholics, and the English department at the University of Minnesota was the most alcoholic department in the entire country. They were very jealous of their status, and they protected it and extended it. This was a time when all great writers were self-destructive people. They were chain smokers, and they were alcoholics. Faulkner and Hemingway and Fitzgerald, of course, and Sinclair Lewis and Eugene O'Neill, Tennessee Williams, Thomas Wolfe, Dylan Thomas. The list goes on and on and on. Maybe not Laura Ingalls Wilder, but then who knows? And so an English major back in the day felt a certain obligation, you see, to take up the tools of your trade, which were unfiltered cigarettes. Gauloises was the preferred brand, French, but if you couldn't afford that, then Pall Mall would do, Lucky Strikes, Camels, and to smoke 2, 3, 4 packs a day was a sign that you were serious about writing. And to drink as much as anybody else in the room and hold your own was the other way that you showed this. This all changed now. I mean, there are writers who go to gyms, for God's sake. There are writers who jog, you know, you get together with young novelists and they sit there drinking carbonated Italian water, and so this is all different. But back in the day, this was the case. To have this dark view of genius, that genius and this suicidal impulse were intertwined, and you had to have both in order to make your way in the field of literature. This feeling was very, very strong. Well, this all changed when I went into radio. 5 o'clock in the morning, a dark view of life is not of any use or importance. Your listeners have their own dark view, and they're not interested in yours. You are supposed to be a figure of some cheerfulness. Not too cheerful, because this is the Midwest, but a strong, forward-looking, sort of scoutmaster, uncle-like person who plays rousing music. Not too rousing, but, you know, does surprising things, and who offers a spirit of optimism and hope to people, which required that, though this was non-commercial public radio, I had to invent sponsors, because advertising is a platform for optimism and hope. False hope, but nonetheless. And so from that I created powder milk biscuits made from whole wheat that give shy persons the strength to get up and do what needs to be done. And bebop, rebop, rhubarb pie. Nothing gets the taste of shame and humiliation out of your mouth like bebop, rhubarb pie. Rhubarb, the secret of the good life as we know it. And the ketchup advisory board, ketchup filled with natural mellowing agents and all the rest of them. I invented sponsors to give me a chance to use a tone of voice that you couldn't, that you'd be hard put to find a reason to use elsewhere, simply talking about yourself and your own experience, because I wasn't that cheerful at 5 o'clock in the morning. I had to invent cheerfulness. You know, I felt, as so many people would feel who go to work at 5 o'clock in the morning, that you're wasting your life and that you are unappreciated and you can't wait to quit. No, this all happened without taking thought. And then, having created sponsors, it was a natural next step to create a town where these products would come from. And I gave it the name Wobegon, from the Ojibwe word that means the place where we waited for you 2 days in the rain. And then to populate it with German Catholics and Norwegian Lutherans, and to create the Sons of Canute and Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility and the Norwegian Bachelor Farmers and the Sidetrack Tap, the Chatterbox Cafe, Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, all of those. And without intention, truly without intention, you find that you have created this magnum opus that you will spend 40 years talking about and still feel you've only begun to scratch the surface. This is amazing, especially compared to the novel I was writing when I went into radio, which was dreary and which was hopeless and which I was glad to execute. It was a novel about Minneapolis, which was the biggest city I knew anything about, and the narrator was a young, alienated, so I thought, young man who was an outsider, the worst possible narrator because he didn't know anything. In Lake Wobegon, just about every character knows a great deal about just about every other character, so that you can choose your narrator from any part of town. This is beautifully complicated, I think. Blind luck. And that's the message. That's the message. I'm not here to sell this book. It's a compilation of things I've written over the years. But there are some good sentences in it, and a number of sentences that I'm fond of. And so I may as well just quote them. And then we'll see if there are any questions from this fine seminar here in the literary criticism poetry section of University Bookstore. This is my favorite. The way to get something done is to do it. And the way to stop doing something is to not do it anymore. Isn't that good? I love that. I wish I'd known that when I was your age, but we do the best we can. there's only so much you can do, and you should do that much. And when you do that much, you will find out there is more that you could do, and you should do that as well. Be kind to strangers. You were a stranger once yourself, and you will be again. On the other hand, your home is not the bus depot. Scripture says to give all that you have to the poor, but if you did, then you would be poor, and then they would have to give everything back. So that isn't going to work. But anybody can give 10%. Do unto those who don't like you before they can do what they want to do unto you. Do good to them before they can do the despicable things you know they would like to do to you. Kill them with kindness. Poison them with politeness. Use Christian charity as a weapon. Never talk about the relationship with the other person. Just don't. You're digging a hole for yourself. And no matter how gentle and kind you think you are, you will say something in the course of this discussion that will scorch their heart, and they will remember it for years to come. Never talk about the relationship with the other person. And never use the word relationship. Either it's a friendship, or it's a romance, or you're already married, or you're related, or you're in business together, your classmates, your neighbors, something. The solution to your problems almost always is to have more fun. This is how you solve these problems with another person. The secret of mothering and fathering is to make no sudden moves. Don't raise your voice. Give the child plenty of room. Keep all thoughts of disaster to yourself. And insofar as possible, find something that you and the child both enjoy doing and do it, even if it almost kills you. Tall people cannot count on short people to take care of things that we would bump our heads on. We have to look after these things ourselves. They will leave the cupboard door open so that you, chopping onions on a chopping block on the counter, your eyes filled with tears, suddenly you stand up and you ram your head into the corner of the cupboard door hard so that you forget the words to America the Beautiful. This is your own fault. You cannot blame this on other people. Likewise, if you expect a good birthday party past the age of 18, you have to give it yourself. You can't hope that other people will rise to the occasion. Wonderful things can be done in small increments. And if you, coming home at night, put your billfold or purse, your car keys, your glasses, your cell phone in a dish by the door, with the time you save not looking for them the next morning, you will be able to write War and Peace. Don't make fun of crazy people. You may well be one of them. Take care of your friends, even when they lose their interest for you, because there will come a time when there is no reason to like you except out of long-standing habit. And you will want those people at that time. Life is short. Don't put beans up your nose. On the other hand, don't buy cheap shoes. My favorite, and I'll close with this, because this, I think, was the precept of my parents. Cheer up. Cheer up. It could be worse. Someday it will be. Be thankful for the difference.
Stay tuned for more from our guest, Mr. Garrison Keillor, on Speakers Forum. Slate magazine once called his appeal a, quote, folksy benevolent force, mysterious. You be the judge. After the break, he'll take questions from the audience at University Bookstore. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. You're tuned to KUOW 94.9 Seattle and part three of today's Speakers Forum with Garrison Keillor. Back in 2011, Keillor said he was getting ready to retire, but he later changed his mind. He says now he loves doing Prairie Home Companion and can't find a good reason to quit. Next up, questions from the audience at University Bookstore.
So that's that. Any questions from this interesting group of people here? Anything that I left out of this discussion here that you are curious to know about? Yes, you're thinking of asking a question, and and you're just trying to word it.
I want to word it well.
You want to word it well because, you know, you're talking to an English major here. And
you seem to have a phenomenal...
I'm sorry, here.
You seem to have a phenomenal memory to be able to quote things out of your book and to do all the stories that you do and to bring it all like it's fresh. What's your process of doing all of this? I mean, how does it work in your world to remember all of this?
You will remember anything you've written that made sense. I mean, you may not remember it exactly when you need to know it, but you will remember it. There's no reason to read a speech off a, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't do it. The News from Lake Wobegon is, you know, off the top of my head, and it's like Mark Twain said, when you tell the truth, you don't need to remember what you said last time. So, truthfulness. Do you believe me or no? You believe me? I got some lakefront property in Minnesota that, we could talk about. No, I don't have a great memory, but you know, I work at it, and it's good to stand up in front of people without notes, and in this way, panic, you know, delivers you some material. Yes, the young lady who's turned out very well, turned out in the beautiful hat, as if you're going to a christening or something here. Yes.
Not yet. I was wondering, do you have a maritime background? I heard a lot of port and forward and aft references in your story, and I was wondering if you have a maritime background to back that up.
Is that all you need for a maritime background?
My husband is like third generation, so he never maritime, so he never goes to the bathroom. It's always the head, and it's always port and starboard for giving directions. So I just heard that a lot, and I was curious.
Yeah. Well, I haven't gone to the head, and and I doubt that I will. But no, I'm just tossing out the word port there to, you know, to sound more sophisticated. And, fore and aft. I mean, how else would you say that? You put this gown on your front and this gown on your back. But I don't know. Fore and aft just seems a little fancier.
No complaints.
But yeah. But I don't have any other maritime terms. That's the limit right there. And so not much more I can do. Yes, sir, in the back.
Is there a relationship between Lake Wobegon and Holdingford, Minnesota?
is there a relationship between Lake Wobegon and Hollingford? Well, Hollingford is an interesting town. It's a town with two Catholic churches, one Polish and one German, which have been unable to work out a merger. They have one priest who serves both, and their services are conducted in English, but one is Polish and the other one is German. I admire that kind of stubbornness, maybe in some part, I think Lake Wobegon is maybe a little bit larger than Hollingford. Hollingford has a beautiful water tower, one of those great, beautiful, classic water towers that sits on what is it, six legs, and the tank up at the top and the name printed on the side. So I'm fond of Hollingford, but I don't know anybody in Hollingford, and so I don't know anybody well enough to exploit their stories. You see, so. I'd like to imagine that it's based on Hollingford. Would you believe me if I said it were?
Yes.
Okay, all right, then it is. It's Hollingford. It's Hollingford, block by block and person by person. Yes, sir.
It appears to me, or as I listened over the years to your radio show, Prairie Home Companion, that it's almost modeled after going to church, where you have your songs, you have your scripture in certain segments, and then you finish up with the story, if you will. I was wondering if there was a conscious effort on your part, or if not, how you constructed the show. Did you construct it off of having gone to church in your early youth or along your life?
Well, the church I went to was a church without liturgy. It was an evangelical fundamentalist church, the Sanctified Brethren, and there men in the assembly stood up as the Spirit led, and they spoke, or they gave out a verse or a hymn or something. The singing was much worse than on a Prairie Home Companion. It was a cappella singing, and there was a kind of a wailing, kind of a mournful quality of it. Sort of like the wives of fishermen mourning for their lost husbands. If you want to know the truth, I'm not in that church anymore, but I wouldn't see a connection there. I go to a sad Episcopal church, a fading Episcopal church, high church, you know, with smoke and mirrors, and there, you know, you have your processional, your opening hymn, you've got your readings from Scripture, your little prayer set in there. We all chant the psalm and then the gospel and then the sermon. I don't think so. But you're not the first person to think that a Prairie Home Companion was a sort of a church. I think maybe people are listening to it on Sunday morning and they're hoping to get credit for it. So that's what they're referring to. The store is closing in 10 minutes. So.
Hi. I wonder how often do you do this? I feel like this is almost a stealth event. I just happened to learn about this by being here in the bookstore the other day and seeing that you were doing a reading here, and it doesn't seem like this is. You know, I mean, this is really wonderful. This isn't like a huge arena, and everyone is 100 yards away from you. You know, and you know, we're all just very close here, and this is really nice. So, is this unusual for you to do instead of a big concert, a big performance, or do you do these sort of small, intimate gatherings more often?
Well, I'm doing a number of them for this. for this book because I owe it to the publisher, even for the tiny advance they paid me for this. I still have a contract to write two more books for Viking, and then I would like to actually write a couple more after that. And so to build credit at this big publishing house, which is now merged, you know, with Random House, and so it's enormous, I need to go around and win and curry favor among booksellers and book salesmen. But no, I do this often, all the more so as the show goes on, because although A Prairie Home Companion is produced independently by an independent production company, nonetheless, there are all of these number crunchers in public radio who have audience numbers and data on demographics, and I'm not interested in what they have to say, and so I need to have another reality of actual people who I look at and who I assume listen to the show. I don't know. I'm not passing out questionnaires, but I need to have a feeling that this show is done for real people, and not for a chart, you know. And so that's my reason for doing it. I did a little reading, or whatever you call this, in Phoenix, and a 106-year-old woman named Pearl was there on her daughter's arm, but she, Pearl, was sharp as a tack, and her hearing was very good, and her eyesight, 106. She just was a little shaky on her legs, but otherwise she was in fine fettle, and she said, "I hope you're not planning to retire anytime soon." And when a woman of 106 wants you to stick around, I mean, it sort of gets your attention. But I would never know about her from, you know, reading charts and so forth. Yes, sir.
What's your average day like? Are you an early riser? Do you stay up late? What's your coffee drinker?
Uh-huh.
What's the secret here?
Well, I used to sleep late, and then about 11 years ago, just on my own hook, for very good reason, I just cut off drinking alcohol in any form whatsoever, and it was a. It changed my day. When you stop drinking, it gives you back your morning, which before had been, you know, clouded, and sometimes you wouldn't really get real morning until noon. But when you don't drink, then your mind is quite clear when you get up in the morning, and. So I go to bed before my daughter does. She's 16. I go to bed around 9, and I like to get up around 4, and that gives me 4 hours before things are really cracking at our house, and those 4 hours, depending on the time of year, are partly in the dark. And I like to sit in the dark with a cup of coffee and a laptop in a little room in my house downstairs and sit and work. And that's when you've got your best work done. when you've been working on something the day before, and you come to a point of blockage or confusion, and you just cannot see where it's supposed to go, the solution almost always is to put it away and don't worry it, and get up early the next morning and look at it, and the answer will be there. That's just what I find to be true. What do I do in an average day? That's pretty much it. I work. I don't have hobbies that I'm aware of. I go to movies to accompany my wife, and I go to the opera to accompany my wife, and I go to, you know, if the orchestra is playing Mahler, we go hear Mahler because that's what my wife wants to do, and I'm fine with that. So I guess my wife is my hobby, really. But I like that. I'm a sociable person, but I'm almost always silent in company, and so there are not too many people who can tolerate that. My own family does very well. My in-laws, not so well. A silent man sitting at the table. I guess it is odd, but it's just how I am. I think when you talk on the radio for a living, you're not inclined to give speeches at the dinner table. I'm a writer, and writers are listeners. You know, we're observers. That's what we're supposed to do. That's where we get our ideas, and all the more so as it's Thursday. And the show is on Saturday, and you need material. You get very quiet. Yes. Was there a blah, blah, blah? Yes, in the back, yes.
How can one get a beautiful mellifluous voice like you have?
Well, you spend 40 years in radio, I think, and it weathers your voice. You go through different periods of imitation in radio because you know you have a good ear, and so you hear other voices, especially when you're younger, and you imitate them. I started out sounding like Edward R. Murrow, or tried to, and I think there was a time when I imitated Chet Huntley, the newscaster. And you are all illegal trespassers. But over the years you develop a voice for yourself, which is not necessarily the voice that you grew up with, but it's the voice that you that jibes with what you hear. In other words, I don't know. All right. So is that covered? Yes, sir.
I just want to say thank you for that wonderful tribute album you did about Mark Twain.
Oh.
All those other great artists.
Oh, yeah.
A few years ago. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I loved. I'm not sure which album you're referring to, but I did read Huckleberry Finn on an audio CD. And with
Clint Eastwood and all the musicians.
Oh, that one, yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't all do that at the same time in the same studio, but anyway, I haven't heard that myself. Well, maybe someday I'll take a long car trip. Yes, sir.
You've been asked many questions. What question never gets asked?
Well, the question my aunt, a couple of my aunts used to ask me that I keep waiting for somebody to ask me, and nobody ever does. Would that qualify?
Thumbs up.
All right. Okay. They would say, "Are you resting in the Lord?" They would say. Sometimes they would say, "Are you saved? You know, do you have the knowledge of salvation? Are you resting in the Lord?" They would come right straight at you. Because every summer there was a revival service, and an evangelist, Brother Bob, would come to town with this enormous Bible in his left hand, and he would stride up and down in front of, there were probably 50, 60 people there under the tent, and you had never come forward, and your aunts were aware of this, and so they would always ask you that question: "Are you resting in the Lord? Are you do you know where you're going when you die?" But nobody ever asks me that question anymore. Are you resting in the Lord? Are you resting in the Lord? Yeah, it's a very good question.
How would you answer them at that point in time? How did you answer your aunts then?
How did I answer that question when I was a kid?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't want to worry my aunts. I loved my aunts. I loved them dearly. And I would say whatever I believed they wanted me to say. And to preserve their feelings and to give them a sense of security and peace, I would always say yes. Always. Myself, I wasn't sure at all, but for my aunt's sake, I would. Yeah. Because if I'd said no, they just would have been tortured. My, we've certainly brought up some heavy things here. And all of you people facing arrest here, yes.
Your beginning in radio in St. John's Abbey, I believe.
Can
you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, I went up and applied for a job there doing an early morning radio show. And that was a great awakening. A Prairie Home Companion started out as a morning show, and that's what I was referring to before when I said that at 5 o'clock in the morning a dark view of life gets you nothing. It was an amazing thing for an English major to feel that you are of use and to be useful to other people, and although an English major might start out by feeling superior to an audience and feeling that, you know, you, brilliant as you are, could never really truly be understood by anybody, and so you are this lonely, unappreciated figure. But in time, you grow up and you want to be of use to people. I still do. I don't know any greater pleasure. Well, I do know greater pleasure, but you know, that's something else.
3 minute corn.
Pardon?
3 minute corn. 3 minute corn.
Sweet corn.
Sweet corn.
Sweet corn. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You only boil it for 3 minutes?
Or what?
Really?
50 seconds.
Out of the garden and into the boiling water.
Oh, really? Really? 3 minutes. That would seem to be a kind of medium rare to me, but maybe it's better. I thought it was always 5 or 6. No?
50 seconds.
What?
50 seconds.
Really? Really? So we've been overcooking our sweet corn?
Well, corn has changed a lot.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a lot more sugar in it now.
Oh, really? Okay. All right. Well, I will go home and repair my ways. Yes, sir. Last question, sir. In the gentleman here in the white cap,
I was going to ask When were you at the University of Minnesota? And, and did you ever know John Berryman?
Yes, yes. I was at the University of Minnesota from the fall of 1960 until 1968, through 1968. I stayed in graduate school hoping to be excused from Vietnam, and so I stayed in school much longer than I really wanted to. And Mr. John Berryman, author of the Dream Songs, was a large figure on campus. His centenary is this year. John Berryman was one more of those writers who waged a lifelong struggle with alcohol. And this was perfectly clear whenever he gave readings, which he often did. And he would stand up in front of an audience in the Museum of Natural History Auditorium at the university and read from his poems, which were difficult enough to read them on the page, but to hear him slur his words as he stood up there and holding on to the lectern like a life raft. And he was an example of the old alcoholic tradition of American letters. He achieved sobriety through AA, and maintained sobriety for the most part. And then a few years later, he committed suicide. He was a man who was haunted by the fact that his father had committed suicide with a shotgun standing on the lawn of the family home under the boy's bedroom window one night. And this was an enormous wound that Mr. Berryman worked around in his work and often referred to in different ways. When I heard that, I realized that I could not be a serious artist because I had the burden of a happy childhood, and my father had always been perfectly decent and wonderful to me, and he'd made me whole potatoes, and I was forced to memorize verses every Sunday, but that's hardly the same thing. So then, thank you so very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's Speakers Forum with Garrison Keillor. His latest book is The Keillor Reader, a compilation of writings spanning his lengthy career. Ever reflective, Keillor wrote the following in a National Geographic essay earlier this year. I was not a good person. I have yelled at my children. I neglected my parents and was disloyal to loved ones. I have offended righteous people. People around here know all this about me. And yet they still smile and say hello, and so every day I feel forgiven. Garrison Keillor spoke at Seattle's University Bookstore on June 12, 2014. Thanks to Ayan Sheikh and University Bookstore for this recording. To listen again to this talk or share it with a friend, wander over to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. While you're there, please let us know what upcoming talks you'd like us to feature. For Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.